Good evening. First of all, I'd like to get out of the way that I did not choose this topic. But I was in a meeting that this topic came up. And if you do not know, that my day job is that I am a law professor at the University of Georgia. And so when they said, hey, we want to know something about a legal case, I said, well, I do that. So I can talk. But know this, I'm not a counselor. I'm not a medical doctor, or any kind of doctor, for that matter. And so I will not be talking about the subject tonight in those capacities. We will not be hearing about how abortion is performed, the different methods of abortion, the different ways that it can be done. We will not be hearing anything about the effect on the mother, emotionally and physically, when an abortion takes place. We will not hear anything about the pain and agony that the child feels during an abortion. That's not my expertise, and that's not what we're talking about. But the law is. And so here, we will talk about it. A case that came out this summer by the Supreme Court. Arguments were heard. Typically, arguments are heard, and it takes a while for the Supreme Court to sort of they send opinions back and forth amongst the justices before they settle. In controversial cases, they typically wait towards the end of the summer term to release them. That way they can go on vacation and everybody can complain, which is kind of what they did with this case. But this case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which is out of Jackson, Mississippi, changed things when it came to abortion and the law relating to abortion. Psalms 138, 139, 13 says, for you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I don't think anyone will rationally and reasonably tell you that the life inside the womb is not a life. No matter how you feel about abortion, they understand that at some point in time, there's a life. And we see that many verses in the Bible that talk about God knowing us in the womb, seeing us in the womb, forming us in the womb. And of course, we have the example of Elizabeth and Mary and their visit where the babies leaped in the womb, where John leaps in the room, knowing that Jesus is nearby. So that's not really a debate. The debate is what is to be done about these situations. So let me give you a little bit of history about abortion. And this was bigger on my PowerPoint at home, so I apologize. Abortion was legal and illegal at various times over the previous two centuries around the world, strangely enough. The Soviet Union became the Soviet Union for about 10 years, they allowed abortions and required that, which maybe says something about having abortions and what kind of state institutions would want that kind of thing. But for the most part, there was a sort of uniformity after what the term quickening was typically used. And typically that just sort of means basically a viability kind of standard. Not a lot of medical knowledge known. You know, technology has grown a lot, and we know a lot more. We can see a lot more, but you know, there were no ultrasounds in the 1800s, 1700s, or whatever. And so they just went. But you know that at the early stage of pregnancy is a tender stage. And sometimes it doesn't sit. Sometimes it doesn't connect. So the quickening would be after we know that the pregnancy is a good pregnancy and it's going to last a little longer. But before quickening, there was no uniformity as to what was to be done or what was permitted. By the late 1960s, though, abortion was illegal in most of the world. And in fact, in 1967, the American Medical Association issued a report that strongly opposed abortion. In it, they said, we have to call it what it is, life is life. And it was illegal in a majority of the states around about 1970. Except in cases of where the life of the mother was in jeopardy. Alabama actually had a slightly different wording where it said if the health of the mother were in jeopardy. And health and life of the mother, that's a broader standard and would encompass some other sort of factors, perhaps. But that's where the law stood, basically, at around 1970. In the late 1960s, a few states were allowing abortions up to 24 weeks for any reason. And in 1970, just 3 years later, the American Medical Association completely changed their tune on abortion. And they issued a report saying that we should be allowed, and we should have these clinics that should pop up everywhere, and they should have abortions there, and it should be cost-effective and available for on a wide scale. Complete change. The Supreme Court in 1971 overturned a D.C. law that permitted abortions. But then in 1972, arguments were heard in Roe v. Wade. And in January 1973, Roe v. Wade is released. And that decision basically said that it prohibited any restrictions on abortions through the first trimester, but it allowed for restrictions in the third trimester and said, we don't really know what to do in the second trimester. So it created this sort of three separate times in a pregnancy. And the law was different depending upon the time. So let's talk about the law. Now we turn to con law. I know that's why you came. I wanted to learn a little con law. Maybe con law too, actually. This would be covered probably about a week, week and a half at a normal law school. But when you're talking about individual rights, you're talking about weighing the competing interests of the individual's rights and liberty versus the state's interest in restricting or prohibiting behavior. And every law is sort of valued that particular way. There's a balancing that goes on in every type of law. And the constitutional standards for evaluating a law, there's three different standards that you have to go by. The highest is called strict scrutiny. And under strict scrutiny, the government has to have a compelling interest. And they're in involving themselves in the freedom and liberty of an individual. They have to have a compelling interest. It's a high standard. And whatever limitations that they have must be narrowly tailored to that compelling state interest. It's a high standard. In between that, not very well named, is intermediate scrutiny. And then finally, the lowest is called rational basis scrutiny. And under rational basis, the state's interest only need to be legitimate. And then the action or restriction must just be rationally related to what it wants to prohibit. So it's a very low standard for what's going on. And here's a nice little chart that you can't read that basically lays that whole thing out. But if you want to pull this up later, you can see the chart and see how it divides up between strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, and rational basis analysis. So prior to Roe versus Wade, abortion was treated as though under a rational basis analysis. And it was used because the state claimed to have an interest in three things. At least that's what they claimed in the Roe decision. The first was discouraging illicit sexual conduct. They didn't really argue that. They just kind of threw that out there. But that was the reason that was given. The second was protecting women from dangerous procedures. You've all heard stories or know the ideas of sort of a back alley abortions or abortions that were performed in ways that were unsanitary or unhealthy. And so it's the state's interest to make sure that those kinds of things don't happen. And finally, the state claimed an interest in protecting prenatal life. And that was presented to the court in Roe v. Wade. But Roe had their own idea. They came up with, for the first time, a right to privacy. It's what they referred to it as, a right to privacy. This is the rationale. Now, the right to privacy is not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution. And for lawyers, that's a problem. It's a problem when something's not there and you say it's there. Where did they get it from? Well, they said that privacy is sort of, well, it's not specifically stated, it's inferred in other constitutional rights, such as when the First Amendment, where you have a freedom of speech and freedom of religion, that's a private choice, they said. Or the Fourth or Fifth Amendment, where you have a right against unreasonable searches and seizures, a right to be sort of protected in your own home. That's privacy, after all. Or the Sixth or the Ninth Amendment, sort of a reservation. Basically, it says if the Constitution doesn't prohibit, then in those rights, then individuals can do it. That never flies, but for some reason in Roe, that was at least an argument that was given. So the term sort of that it's not in the Bill of Rights, it's not in the Constitution, but it fits under the penumbra of the Bill of Rights. And that's sort of the phrase that you may have heard before, that it's in the penumbra of rights is where we get our right to privacy. What's also considered is in the 14th Amendment, what's called due process, and the concept of ordered liberty. Personal rights are related to, implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, which gets us now deep into the woods and con law to a thing called substantive due process. The Constitution, in several places, the 5th and 14th Amendment notably, provides that everyone is entitled to due process. And typically that's thought of as procedural due process, like I'm allowed time to hear. There's a method. We're not going to have someone just be a judge, jury, executioner all at once. There's going to be a process involved. We're going to take our time for whatever happens. Procedural due process, and that's how it was sort of understood. However, in the 1930s, during the Depression, the Supreme Court came up with an idea of substantive due process, which they said was something that related to what was required to really, if you're going to be an American, to have a chance for life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, that you really had these other rights that maybe weren't included explicitly in the Constitution, but were part of substantive due process. Now, typically, when they first started and the first idea, they were considered what we say an economic right, like a right to open your own ice cream shop, you know, a right to travel, a right to, you know, retire, right to not work, you know, those kind of personal freedoms that in order to be an American and enjoy freedom, you would have that kind of economic interest. However, that soon spawned off into the concept of fundamental rights. And that term started being used, fundamental rights, as opposed to a constitutional right. Now, if something is considered a fundamental right, it's treated as a constitutional right. And that means, when we go back to our analysis, that we're going to use strict scrutiny analysis if we're talking about a constitutional right, as opposed to if you don't have a constitutional right, then we just use rational basis analysis. So, in Roe, the Supreme Court determined that the fundamental rights protected by substantive due process are those, deeply rooted, and here's the key language, and sort of interesting language, are those deeply rooted in U.S. history and tradition, viewed in the light, and here's another key phrase, of evolving social norms. These rights are not explicitly listed in the Bill of Rights, but rather are in the penumbra of certain amendments that refer to or assume the existence of such rights. This has led to the Supreme Court to find that personal or relational rights, as opposed to economic rights, are fundamental and protected on that highest level. So some fundamental rights that has been determined by the Supreme Court where they use this same type of analysis. In 1965, in a case called Griswold, the Supreme Court said that there's a right to use contraception, that that's a privacy right and that's a fundamental right. 2 years later, in Loving versus Virginia, they said that you have a right to marry someone of a different race. That's a fundamental right. You can basically marry who you want to marry. And overturning a Virginia law that said you could not marry someone of a different race. Pre-viability abortion, Roe, the same analysis was used. And the same analysis was used in Obergefell, which was a 2015 case, which said that marriage could be a same-sex marriage. Because after all, we're looking at something and calling that a fundamental right. And if you call it a fundamental right, then it's going to be very difficult for the government, to a state government, to create any law prohibiting that or restricting it in any particular way. Now, I think it's interesting to note or look and see that even in Roe itself, the Roe decision knows that the grant of this right wasn't absolute. Three quotes from the Roe decision itself say that a state may properly assert interest, important interest in safeguarding health and in maintaining medical standards and protecting potential life. It went on to say that at some point in the pregnancy, these respective interests become sufficiently compelling to sustain regulation of the factors that govern the abortion decision. The right to privacy involved, therefore, cannot be said to be absolute. Now, that doesn't necessarily square with everything else we have, because typically the rights we are given in our Bill of Rights, we consider them to be pretty close to being absolute, pretty close to being things that we can count on. So to say that there is this fundamental right, but it's not really absolute, already shows that Roe understood that this is a little shaky ground that it was standing on. But you don't have a right to do whatever you feel like or want to do. You don't have the right to do whatever you want with your own body. Laws that prohibit drug use or prostitution or suicide are all considered constitutional, and there's no problem with that whatsoever. So Roe was decided, and abortions now become legal across the land. It becomes impossible for states to regulate abortions through the first trimester, maybe through the second trimester, but only if they regulate it all, only during the third trimester. So what's been the result of Roe since 1973? Well, between 1973 and 2020, there were approximately 64 million elective abortions in the United States. To put that into context, that's the equivalent to the current population of the state of Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, Arkansas, South Carolina, North Carolina combined. The entire Southeast population right now is about 64 million. And 64 million abortions have taken place. Imagine what the country would look like if those lives had been saved. Put a different way, I don't think that we can really, at least I think, that COVID-19 has been treated as the greatest public health crisis in our lifetime. For 2.5 years, our lives have been sort of turned upside down over this virus. It's the greatest public health concern. Why? Because of the death. Well, as of now, 2.5 years into COVID, approximately 1.2 American people have died of COVID. 1.2 million. That's, on average, the number of abortions that have taken place over the last 50 years, each year. So we treat COVID, which has 1/10 and 1/163 of the problem. We have to understand that what's going on with these abortions is a significant, significant public issue. So what happens? Well, along comes a case called Dobbs. But before we get to there, the Supreme Court had an opportunity in 1992 to review Roe versus Wade in a case called Casey versus Planned Parenthood. In that case, the Supreme Court upheld Roe's sort of suspicious first trimester, second trimester, third trimester reasoning, but said, we're getting away from this right of privacy, but we are going to say and reaffirm that is a fundamental right of a woman to have an elective abortion in the first trimester. So, the state of Mississippi passed a law that said that you could not have any elective abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Typical pregnancy list goes to about 36 to 40 weeks. So 15 weeks is basically the first trimester. So Mississippi is setting this case up. We're setting up right at the edge. We're not talking about first trimester. We're talking right there in the second trimester. Right? That's the border. That's the line. And some critics of the Supreme Court will say that the Supreme Court went too far, that they could have ruled on Dobbs without overturning Roe. But the logic doesn't fit. So what the Supreme Court did in Dobbs is they said that they overturned Roe and Casey and said that there is no fundamental right to abortion because it's not deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition. Because it's not. It's not deeply rooted in our tradition. And it is not an essential component of ordered liberty. Now, what does that mean? It means if there's no fundamental right to an abortion, that means that a state is now focused on just regulating it under the lowest standard of rational basis. If it was a fundamental right, it had to be analyzed under strict scrutiny. But the Supreme Court in Dobbs said it is no longer a fundamental right, therefore, it's just something that a state can do whatever they want to do with. And they focused a lot on this. Justice Alito focused on this, and I think it's an important aspect. I'll go back. The same week that this case was released, there was a case that came out of New York State where the New York State had restricted the process and the purchase of how you would get handguns. And the Supreme Court overturned that New York statute saying that that was not permitted. You weren't allowed to do that because there is a Second Amendment right to bear arms. There is a constitutional right to that, and under strict scrutiny, we're not going to allow it. Now, that came out the same week as Roe, and so you understand the difference. When the Supreme Court said it's not a fundamental right, we can analyze it under a rational basis standard, it changes things. And they made this point. They said abortion is different from other rights in that it destroys potential life or unborn human beings. No other example of a fundamental right destroys. And since it's not a fundamental right, the state legislature is viewed, the Mississippi statute was viewed under the lowest standard of rational basis and viewed to be constitutional. So what's next? Well, as I've already said, each state now can determine where to draw the line or if they want to draw the line at all. And the decision to draw the line in the first trimester will now be lawful, will now be permitted, as long as it's rationally based to foster a legitimate state interest, that lower constitutional standard. If it's rationally based to foster a legitimate state interest and life is a legitimate state interest. So in America, what the court basically did is it basically punted it back to the states. It punted it back to the legislature. Because under our system of government, contrary to what a lot of people believe, You know, they're not just supposed to raise their hand and the president's supposed to do everything. No, no, the legislatures are the ones that are the voice of the people. And they're the ones that are supposed to act. So political fights are more appropriate than for the legislature than the courts. And your vote counts. And this issue is going to be an issue on the ballot, whether it's not actually, you know, you check it off on the ballot, but it is going to be. Representatives are going to have to talk about their position here, and it's going to be something that you're going to have to know and should be aware of when you vote. But I'll make this point. Violating the law is sin, even if you don't like the law. I mean, if it says 55 miles an hour and you go 60, you violated the law and you sinned, okay? But just because something is lawful does not mean it's without sin. And I think that's something that we have understood when it comes to this particular issue for over 50 years, that although it is lawful, and there's a lot of things that are lawful, you're not going to get arrested for them, but they would be considered sinful behavior. So some things to consider as you leave, things that I won't answer, but just things for you to think about as we try to consider where we really want the line to be drawn on this particular issue. And one is this: if life begins at conception, can there be an exception for rape or incest? Because if you're really just talking about the life of the unborn child, of the choice of the mother, if you're talking about an exception for rape and incest, you're now talking about the choice of the mother, and we're forgetting that. Can those two things be squared in your mind? Do we really want to have to explain all miscarriages to the government? If we have such restrictive laws that ban abortion completely, well, people get pregnant all the time, and people lose those pregnancies in an early stage. I don't know the statistics for it, but it happens. It's probably happened to several people in this audience that are watching. It's not a guarantee. And pregnancies are lost all the time of no fault at all of the mother. And there's no blame whatsoever. Do we really want to have to give an explanation to show that we were actually doing the right thing? Do we really want a government official that's wondering what's going on? If someone is required to carry a baby to term against their will, are we willing to be there to assist? Are we there to help these people out? What role should fathers play? Financial support? Maybe during the pregnancy? Maybe they should be part of the decision-making process. You know, it takes two people to get pregnant. But the abortion decision seems to fall on one much more than the other. Is that fair? Is that the way that it should be? And sort of the last thing I'd like you to consider is this: will more restrictive laws force a quick decision without complete information or contemplation? For 50 years now, it's part that's almost been woven into our fabric of our society that abortion is fine, that abortion is okay. At any stage, any time, there are a lot of people that will say that. And it has been promoted as part of normal birth control activities. And so that's still there. So imagine if you have a heartbeat law that requires, you know, if you hear a heartbeat, you're not allowed to get an elective abortion. What is that going to force people who want an abortion to not ask for a heartbeat, to not ask for a test, to lie about how long it's been since they thought they became pregnant in order to fit that earlier category? And if they have to make a decision quickly, are they going to make the right decision? If someone is walking into an abortion clinic a trauma has occurred in their life so that they think this is a way to fix it. They need time to contemplate their decision. So maybe laws that require a waiting period are things that allow for the decision-making process to be better. God has given us free will to choose to do what we want to do. And Adam and Eve at the very beginning blew it. Okay? And we do every day. But for this most significant activity, wouldn't it be best if we have time for thoughtful consideration? Because I bet many choices would be made to keep the baby than abort if they have to think about what is truly going on. For you were created in my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. We finished where we started. So what is our role? What do we take out of this? Well, in my opinion, and this is now me talking as me, not law professor, because we're out of that now. I think our role is not to judge. I think our role is not to fire off hostile rhetoric. I think our role is to love. Love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. What is our role? I think our role is to support those organizations that seek to help people make informed decisions, that are there for those women who are struggling with this decision and are thinking about this particular choice. And there are a lot of organizations out there that reach out and try to provide helpful services to people who are in this situation. Because if you've gone to an abortion clinic, if you are at an abortion clinic, a trauma has occurred in your life that you think this is a good idea. Those people do not need to be yelled at. Those people do not need to be screamed at. Those people need to be loved because they are struggling. And if we love them, perhaps they will make the decision a better decision, a decision of life, and a decision to love because they've seen the love that we can give to them. So I'm finished. I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer questions if you have any questions about anything that I've discussed with you this evening. At the end of our service, though, we always offer an opportunity to come forward if there's a particular need. We're all sinners. We all have our problems. We all have our issues. That's why we come together and worship, not to show off, but to support each other. So if anyone needs the support or love of the church, they can come forward as we stand and sing.